Welcome to the Climate Diplomacy Podcast, a podcast from Adelphi, bringing you the latest insights and debates in international climate diplomacy. We are your hosts, Raquel Monayat and Hanna Kuonut. In this series, you will hear from leading experts offering their take on what needs to be done to promote climate foreign policy and provide you with the context you need to understand climate diplomacy today. For more information, please visit climate-diplomacy.org or follow us on Twitter under Climate Diplo.
In this episode, we will speak about the food security and climate change nexus. Today, I will interview my colleague and co-host Raquel Monayat, who focuses on food and agriculture issues in light of climate and environmental change. She is working as a consultant for climate security and diplomacy at the Berlin think tank Adelphi and our internal food security expert. We would like to apologize for any small audio disruptions that might occur due to remote recording. Welcome to the guest seat, Raquel.
Thanks, Hanna. Now I will find out how our guests feel.
So let's jump right in. Food security is a buzzword that is all over the climate change discourse. For example, in our regional risk briefs from the Climate Security Expert Network, there is no single assessment that doesn't see climate change as a driver of food insecurity. What can you tell us about this?
Well, you said it right, Hanna. There's virtually no context in which we see impacts of climate change, but don't see any impacts, or at least, an imminent risk of food insecurity as a result of these changes. And that's just because, as opposed to the many aspects of our lives that we are able to control, for food production, we're pretty much at the mercy of the weather and of the resources. And this is also the case for developed countries, by the way. So for contexts in which farmers have more access to support mechanisms or utilizing state-of-the-art farming technologies. Farmers under such conditions, they might be more resilient to climate change than others, of course, but pressure also mounts for them and they become less and less resilient with time. So, you know, because to produce food, we need certain amounts of water. This water must be of good quality. We need soil and the soil must have a rich biodiversity. We need specific amounts of sunlight, regulated temperature fluctuations, et cetera, et cetera.
That sounds like a very complex system. And it reminds me of my houseplants. They're so sensitive to every little change and so easy to kill. It makes me crazy.
Yes, that's actually a great example. With houseplants, we all get a glimpse of how difficult it actually is to keep plants healthy. And, you know, each plant species out there has been adapting to their own climate and to its cycles also for millennia. And they don't do very well, actually, when this delicate balance is disrupted. So imagine if your houseplants were actually not just a few pots, but a whole field on which you and your entire family fundamentally depend. And also imagine that outside, you're not able to move your plants around and put them in a better spot. You can't control the temperature. So everything has to work by itself and it has to work. And then we add to this the full picture of biodiversity. So the need for pollinators and also other animals that support farms and farming activity by fertilizing soil, by hunting crop eating animals like rodents and insects. And then we have livestock, which on the one hand, provide certain ecosystem services as well, but also require extensive amounts of grass and water, which in turn also require land and pollinators and water, et cetera. And that's only for speaking of grass-fed, free-range livestock. I'm not even mentioning the ones fed with grains, which is a whole other dimension for the climate discussion. We won't enter into this issue of livestock and climate change today, but I feel it's important to highlight that this is a discussion in itself. But to go back to our issue of the day, when we think of how complex agriculture actually is and how much it's dependent on a delicate flow of regular and balanced cycles, we realize that farming would already be difficult without a changing climate, right? So the simple need to manage all these elements in light of normal fluctuations, it's already a giant task. And success in a natural context is generally very limited. And I guess this explains why modern humans have come up with so many ways to control the farming environment. So for example, by introducing its own means of pest control and fertilization, as opposed to depending on the animals that provide such services.
That's really fascinating. And it explains a lot because the type of climate-related impacts we see throughout the world are all directly related to agriculture. Droughts and floods, biodiversity loss, desertification. But I'm curious about one thing. I also read that agriculture generates about one quarter of the world's greenhouse gas emissions, which, as we know, is the leading cause of climate change. Would you say that food production is also causing food insecurity? If so, why?
Yeah, that's definitely an interesting way to put it. And well, the short answer is yes, food production today does largely impair food production in the future. It does so both by the climatic and the environmental changes that it causes. Research has advanced a lot, and we know today that those measures we've introduced to control the farming environment, so pesticides, fertilizers, etc., they are the reason why. And, you know, they initially appeared miraculous, getting rid of pests and increasing yields or making things grow where they previously hadn't, modifying plant biology to increase not just yields, as we would immediately think, but also nutritional value, plus all the technology that we've came up with to speed up these processes and increase them in scale. So this is a jump that happened in the middle of the 20th century, what we call the Green Revolution, which took place mostly in developing countries. But today we look back at 60, 70 years since this major shift took place, which was just the culmination of a much bigger shift that started around 12,000 years ago with the advent of agriculture. And we're looking at large-scale environmental destruction, which in many cases we can directly attribute to agriculture. So deforestation, water pollution and depletion, biodiversity loss, which includes soil biodiversity, the conversion of delicate habitats, such as peatlands and mangroves. And these two that I just mentioned, they are major carbon deposits. They're crucial for climate mitigation, by the way. And we don't talk about them enough. The list goes on. And unsurprisingly, food production is already suffering the blow. And to cushion this blow, farmers end up utilizing more of these inputs and of these methods that put them there in the first place. Yeah, it's a vicious circle. And it's understandable because farmers' livelihoods depend on the success of their crops. In other cases, such as with large-scale corporations, it's less about livelihoods and more about profit. But at the end of the day, whatever the scale or the motive behind inaction on climate change in the agricultural sector, the truth is that we're running out of the resources to sustain this snowball effect, and it's time for big change.
I hear you. Well, it's not flash news that we must act fast on climate change. We all should know this by now. By talking about the specific ways in which our food systems are endangered by it, and at the same time causing so much damage and making climate change worse, does give a renewed urgency to forwarding climate action in our food systems. Speaking about food systems, the Food Systems Summit is taking place next month. They claim that the summit will awaken the world to the fact that we all must work together to transform the way the world produces, consumes, and thinks about food. What do you think will be the biggest challenge on starting this transformation?
You know, I think the biggest challenge by far is overcoming the narrative of increasing food production. So this is a narrative that we see everywhere that says, oh, you know, we need to increase food production because population is growing, etc. And it isn't very accurate. Yes, there are places in the world where decreasing yields or rapid onset shocks to food production have led to hunger or even conflict. So this is the case for several countries that are dependent on food aid and also have increasingly been so for the past decades. Just to mention a few examples, we have Afghanistan, Haiti, several countries in the Sahel region. In these cases, and also a few others, food deficit is a real issue, which must certainly be tackled. But for the rest of the world, food insecurity arises not from lack of sufficient food, but rather from lack of access to it. So food security, it's a four-dimensional concept. And we talk a lot about one of these dimensions, which is availability. So of course, sufficient food supply is of utmost importance for food security. That's clear to everyone. But we do undermine the other three dimensions, which are access, utilization, and stability. Access, it's an enormous issue behind food insecurity, which we should talk about more because tackling it doesn't require necessarily increasing food production or using more resources. Basically, we just have to make sure people have the physical and the economic means to access food. So let me just say a few more words on the other two dimensions as well. So utilization means how nutritious food is and whether you're able to prepare it properly. So for example, if a family were to receive several sacks of grains, it might be considered that they have sufficient food. But of course, lack of nutritional variety can lead to subnutrition or what the WHO calls hidden hunger. And also, if they do not have the fire to cook it, for example, then they can't consume it. So a varied diet and the infrastructure to prepare and consume it are also crucial for food security. And finally, the dimension stability, it reminds us that it's not enough to fulfill the other three dimensions erratically and sporadically. They must be present at all times without interruption in order to define a context as food secure.
I see. So you would say we don't need to produce more food to advance food security?
In a few local contexts, we do, as I mentioned before, but we need to find ways to do it in a way that stands the test of time and already recovers damaged environment. So here we can think of agroforestry, introducing techniques for water efficiency, switching to drought-resistant crops, for example. But on a global scale, definitely not. You see, population growth, it's generally used to justify the need to increase food production. But the truth is that we produce much more food than we need, and we have to talk about it more.
So there was a study in 2012 when global population was just over 7 billion. It concluded that the world was producing food to feed 10 billion people, right? So 3 billion plus than it should be. Almost a decade has passed since the study, and food supply has been rising continuously throughout this period, while global population still didn't cross the 8 billion mark. So what this says is that food production increases at much higher rates than global population. And then we look into the future, and we talk a lot about potential shocks to food production, which is definitely something we should be worrying about. But we don't talk about the fact that according to most estimates of population growth, we are about to reach a peak in the next 80 years or even earlier, after which the world will begin to see a population decline. So in other words, it's very likely that we already produce enough food today to feed the highest estimate of population growth at its peak. Also, and very importantly, we know that food consumption is not so much dependent on population size as it is on wealth. And there are lots of studies on this. This is also important to highlight because if we always connect population size with the need to increase food production, we might inadvertently push the blame for, you know, the resulting environmental and climatic consequences of intensive or extensive agriculture to societies in which birth rates are higher, which also tend to be to places with lower development levels and higher socioeconomic fragility. But as we know, those are actually the least responsible for such climate change and environmental degradation.
But why is this narrative of producing more food to counter the challenges of food insecurity so strong then?
Well, there are a few interest groups out there pushing this increasing food production narrative, and they have a lot of success in hindering climate action. So, of course, several corporations and chemical producers, they come immediately to mind, but smallholder and family farms as well. So we can't just dismiss these interests as purely profit-oriented. There are livelihoods involved in it as well.
Because making food production climate-friendly could impact production in some cases.
So we can't pretend it doesn't make any difference. But the question is that really a problem? And there are two answers to this question. So on the supply side, not so much. To be honest, we can feed entire countries alone with the food that we lose and waste in the several stages between production and consumption. And that's a sad reality in most countries of the world. That includes developing countries, by the way. It's not just in the developed world, industrialized world, as we would think. But for farmers, and that's the other answer to this question, decreasing yields are an existential threat, primarily because of impacts to income. So imagine if your salary would be cut by a third or a fifth tomorrow, but you would need to do the same amount of work or perhaps even more. That's not only unfair, that's also dangerous. About half of the world's adult population are farmers. It varies a lot among regions, so between 20 to 30% in industrialized countries, and it goes up to 80% of the population in the least developed countries. So it's a big portion of the global population. Pushing the costs of climate action to them could lead to civil unrest, it could lead to conflicts and food insecurity, ironically, because even if supply is sufficient, their access to it would be severely reduced given the impacts to income. So transforming food systems require creating safety nets for farmers and making sure that these safety nets also aren't just being used up by corporations.
And I'd also like to add something at this point. So I'm arguing that we might not need to focus on food supply, right? That this isn't the biggest issue affecting food security, at least at the moment. So let's say that I'm wrong, and we are about to enter a very complicated period in which our food supply is in danger. So even in this scenario, focusing on increasing food production doesn't seem like a good option. Because if food supply is ever an issue, the main reasons are environmental degradation and climate change. So to avoid shocks to food supply, those are the issues we should tackle. And that's where we should invest all our attention and all our resources on.
That's very interesting. I feel like I've already learned so many new things today. We talk a lot about population growth, but we never think about this growth stopping or declining. And that is actually such a close reality. Thanks for pointing that out, Raquel. I have one more question. COVID-19 has brought us a whole new range of problems we didn't have before. In the episode 6 of our podcast, we invited the authors of the paper Spreading Disease, Spreading Conflict to talk about how the pandemic exacerbated climate-related security risks. I remember that food security was highly affected by the closure of borders and interruptions in the flow of goods and people. What lessons can we learn from the pandemic in terms of resilient food systems?
Thanks for this question. It's an important aspect to reflect on. Climate change and the COVID-19 pandemic, they both present considerable challenges to food security. But when we think of creating resilience, solutions for these issues, they actually push in two different directions. So when we think of climate change, creating resilience to both slow and rapid onset climate impacts include, on top of adaptation measures, of course, it includes creating a cooperation network that transcends borders. So because climate change is a global phenomenon, but it manifests itself in different ways and at different times on the local and on the regional levels. So that ongoing global food security, it inherently requires a multilateral effort. We can't run from that. But on the other hand, when we think of disease outbreaks, things look very different. This is true not only for pandemics, but also for localized outbreaks. So for example, fear of contagion and regional cross-border movement restrictions, they have caused impacts on food security in West Africa during the Ebola outbreak a few years ago. So such scenarios, they bring to light how important it is to have a certain autonomy when it comes to food production and supplying food on a local level. You know, so what we do with this double information, it's clear that we can't just push countries to aim for self-sufficiency because this would leave those states with less productive capacity or higher vulnerability to climate change. It would leave them in a very dangerous position regarding food supply. So think about locust invasions, for example. They can ravage a small country's crop landscape in a matter of days. So we need cross-border cooperation and a certain surplus in the production of essential crops globally to deal with these kind of crises. But on the other hand, a primarily export-oriented monoculture model, it can't guarantee food security for its population in light of restricted cross-border movements, as we've seen lately. So disease outbreaks are just one of the things that can lead to such restrictions, actually. But they can also stem from political and diplomatic issues, from war and conflict, and even from climate change itself. So for example, with extreme climatic events interrupting trade or closing up important routes. So the lesson we have to learn from the compound threats of climate change and COVID-19 is that a resilient food system is a hybrid system, one that looks inwards, it looks outwards, it cooperates with its neighbors and with the global community in general, but that also works to mitigate climate change on its own grounds and creates protocols to deal with both exogenous and endogenous threats to food supply.
Sounds about right. Let me quickly recap what we spoke about today. First, we looked into how vulnerable agriculture is to a rapidly and erratically changing climate, but at the same time, how much it contributes to the very same climate change. We then spoke about why we need a new narrative that doesn't put all the focus to food supply, but also looks towards increasing access to food, mitigating climate change, and regenerating the environmental systems needed for food production. Then we talked about farmers and the need to protect them from potential impacts to their livelihood and income that could stem from climate mitigation and environmental restoration measures. Finally, we spoke about how climate change and the COVID-19 pandemic remind us that we must be ready to deal with both internal and external threats, with crisis plans for emergency self-reliance while maintaining healthy interdependencies within the international community. Raquel, thank you so much for taking the guest seat today. It was a real pleasure and enlightening to learn about resilience in food systems. I think you explained it also well, making that connection to daily topics, which I really liked, and I hope our listeners enjoyed it as well. Let's hope the Food Systems Summit in July manages to unite the international community under common goals, and we collectively manage to overcome outdated narratives and move forward with creating future-proof food systems in a changing climate. We will be back with another episode of the Climate Diplomacy Podcast in a few weeks. You can reach us with questions and feedback on Twitter at Climate Diplo. Thank you for tuning in. And until next time, goodbye.
Goodbye.